Well, thank you for joining us for this week's episode of the AccuWeather Podcast. I'm joined in the studio by Ken Prowl and Andy Robb. And you know what? I am so lucky. I have like the best producer ever because I mentioned, Ken is just grinning.
Did we hire somebody else?
Oh, thank you.
No, Andy. So here's what happened. I mentioned the topic and Andy found me this little ditty.
October 1871, that's when this great big fire began.
Yeah! What is this?
Well, listen. O'Leary's cow was the one to blame. So you can turn it down now, Andy. Because yes. It'll be stuck in my head now forever.
Yeah. But I've never heard that before in my life.
Yeah, so I heard this song before because I mentioned it to COO Evan Myers is sitting down with me today. Mm-hmm. And so our topic of discussion for today is going to be the Chicago Fire of 1871. And so the rumor, or I don't know if it was a rumor, I guess it's just what
legend.
Was that O'Leary's cow started the fire.
Mrs. O'Leary had a dairy farm or a farm, and a cow apparently knocked over a lantern in a barn.
But
started the Chicago fire.
Is that true? Well, we're going to find out. But we got that little ditty now that will be stuck in our head all day long.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Andy's great. Came from his own personal collection. So he listens to that when he's at home, just hanging out.
Would you like to hear it again?
Oh, please, no.
No, turn it off. Oh, okay.
Okay, fine.
Stay with us.
From our global headquarters in State College, Pennsylvania, it's the AccuWeather Podcast. Here's your host, Regina Miller.
Well, we are joined back in the studio by Evan Myers, and today, Evan, we brought you in to talk about the Chicago Fire of 1871. So thanks for sitting down with me today.
Trivial Pursuit champion, Evan Myers.
I know. Well, you know what? That's a future podcast, yes. And we're going to be talking about that in a couple minutes because I want to have him come in and do a weather Trivial Pursuit, like, you know.
This is all trash talking before I can even get to say anything. But before we came on here, we were talking about, and I don't know what this has to do with the Great Chicago Fire or other great fires.
It doesn't
that have
really matter. It's our
across
podcast.
The United States. I made the statement that before we came on that I have never lost a game of Trivial Pursuit when it wasn't teams. So teams, it's kind of like the team dragged me down. But it's individuals. I've never. So that is really a gauntlet that has maybe that I threw down. But that's for another time.
Absolutely,
because,
a future episode.
That's funny, but the Great Chicago Fire and other related fires are really deadly serious.
I know. They are deadly serious. In fact, here's another little piece of information that I'm going to kind of throw out there, is that the Chicago Fire wasn't even the biggest fire that we ever dealt with.
It wasn't even the biggest fire at the same time the Chicago Fire was going on, believe it or not.
Well, let's start with the Chicago Fire, Evan.
Yes.
First, talk about the fire. Like, when it occurred, how long it lasted, what it did to the city.
So it started on October 8th of 1871, so 6 years after the end of the Civil War. It's interesting because a famous Civil War general actually took command of the city during the height of the fire to help fight it, but it's kind of interesting because the population of Chicago in the census of 1870, just the year before, was about 300,000. And Chicago had grown exponentially. In 1850, the population was 30,000. So just 20 years before, it was so much less. And then 1860 up to 100,000. And by 1870, 300,000. So Chicago was probably the most rapidly growing city in the United States. And the technology that allowed that to happen is one of the reasons why the fire was so bad, so extensive. It's kind of interesting when we've talked about some of these natural disasters over time on these podcasts, it's almost like the technology of the time ran ahead of the ability to understand how the technology caused other issues. The pursuit of technology and the pursuit of money, actually without some breaks and some understanding about the impact, led to some not good things. And we'll see that when we as we talk more about the Great Chicago Fire.
How did it start? Because there's I heard a song, like there used to be a song, something about Bessie the cow or something like that.
So, you know, there's always, there's this folklore that Mrs. O'Leary's cow knocked over a lantern and caused the fire. But it's interesting. There is no evidence, no credible evidence that that actually occurred. And the most credible evidence is that as time went on, especially in the 1880s and the 1890s, as waves of immigrants came into the United States, mm-hmm. that was perpetrated as an actual anti-Irish, anti-Catholic bias to say that, it was immigrants, it was Catholics, or it was Irish that caused the fire to occur. But there's no evidence that that actually, even though it's been perpetuated in folklore, that there's no evidence that that actually occurred. And that actually what happened was, it seems like with the attack on folks coming in, the other people,
like immigrants
mm-hmm. that's where that actually has its origins.
Let's talk about the weather that contributed or was going on maybe leading up to the fire.
In the previous 3 months leading up to that time, from so that would have been September, August, from the beginning of July, before July 4th, 1871, up to this point, 1 inch of rain fell in Chicago and northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin, in that whole area, only 1 inch of rain
wow.
in 3 months. Now, the average rainfall in a year in that area is about 36 inches of rain, 37 inches of rain. So in if you think about it, in a quarter of the year, only 1 inch fell. It was bone dry, extremely dry. Things had dried out tremendously, but most of the structures were made out of wood. So not only was it very dry, was all the grass and the shrubbery and the trees and everything else in a dry state, all the building materials were also dry. They weren't wetted down by any rain or anything like
right.
that. And there were constant winds blowing out of the southwest, out of the west, off the prairie, that helped dry things out even more, helped evaporate what was going on. So the soil moisture content was extremely low. All the wood was dried out. All the shrub, it was a tinderbox.
Yeah.
It was ready for something to happen, whether it was a cow that knocked it over or somebody who threw a cigarette butt anything.
Right.
It was interesting. In fact, there were a lot of fires, and we'll talk about that in a minute. For a while, people thought that maybe meteorites caused the fire.
I had heard that.
Because it was so extensive. The fires were so extensive. But no, there was no evidence of
that.
It was the weather. It was building techniques that caused the fire to explode into a firestorm in Chicago and other places.
Now, just quickly, because normally for Chicago, would they sometimes... It would be Gulf moisture that would help contribute to some of the rain that would come. Would they get moisture up from
the
Gulf?
They get moisture out of the Gulf of Mexico.
Or
also frontal systems coming out of cold fronts coming out of either Pacific or out of Canada.
Okay.
But obviously, none of that happened. It was exceptionally dry and exceptionally hot. So reconstructing what was going on back then, there would have been a very large high pressure area that held from the surface into the upper atmosphere more or less for 3 months, probably sitting right over the mid-Mississippi Valley, blocking any moisture coming up from the Gulf, blocking any frontal systems coming in from the west. But that high pressure area was probably settled a little bit to the south of Chicago, so that helped bring a westerly dry wind in off the Rockies. As the air descends off the Rockies, it also dries out
and warms
and just
up.
Created and warms up and caused that dry wind, that whole dryness to occur.
Well, let's get into what you were saying about, because every time we've done one of these natural disasters, there's always been some kind of human element that's contributed. So let's kind of talk about that.
Well, it's interesting because of rapid industrialization, because of the rapid expansion of the railroads, it wasn't necessary any longer to use indigenous wood to build any kind of city structure.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was, with all the railroads coming in, there was a lot of wood that was brought into Chicago, and Chicago became a focal point because of its location. And there was kind of, they started to build a rivalry with New York City. You can see, we talked about 30,000 people living in Chicago in 1850, 20 years later, 300,000 people. And so they had to do something, and so in order to get all those people there and places for them to live and work, that corresponded with a new logging technique and a new building technique, using extremely long boards.
Mm-hmm.
So up until about 1850, there was no standardized sizes that were used. But starting around the time of the Civil War, we got 2x4s, 4x4s. And instead of the kind of 2x4 you might see today, which is 8 feet in length,
mm-hmm.
we still had a lot of virgin forest, long, big trees. So they would make 2x4s that might be 20 feet long. Just one continuous board. So what they were able to do was...
Wow, you would think that would bow.
what they were able to do is to build structures much faster because you didn't have to worry about, you know, one 8-foot length and then building one story and then building another 8-foot length and putting another story in there for houses. You were able to just put one long board. And so this was called balloon structure, because basically it blew up like a balloon. You could do it so quickly.
Right.
But because of that, there were no natural fire breaks in any structure. Even you think of a house on fire that if it's all wood, it burns rapidly. But having cross beams will prevent fire. All these things are fire breaks. Even though they'll catch on fire, they'll kind of act as a fire break. A floor in which all these beams are nailed into are something that would also be a fire break. But none of those things existed. And they didn't exist because of the advent of industrialization, the advent to allow to build these beams so long with these long trees, and also because it enabled things to be built so much faster. You could mm-hmm. build a structure with a 20 or 30 foot long 2x4 much faster than you could using 8 or 10 foot long 2x4s. So that was one of the reasons why Chicago grew so rapidly. Mm-hmm. So you had all these structures that were built with no natural fire breaks in them at all, even if they were wood houses. On top of that, especially in the downtown area of Chicago, around the Loop and so on, it wasn't called the Loop then yet, but
right.
in the downtown area, there were a lot of advertising billboards on top of roofs. So you had these huge wooden billboards mm-hmm. that were very thin. They were available to burn.
And take it up high, high in the atmosphere.
Exactly,
yeah,
and
right.
allow some of these embers to flow around. So the building structure, the building techniques that were used, it was a perfect storm to allow the fire in any structure to burn rapidly. And this balloon construction often would lead to, if there was a house fire, even in a few minutes, by the time that the fire department arrived, the house would be gone. It burned that fast. So
wow.
things burned so fast that the fire departments, not only in Chicago, but other places that use these building techniques, it was virtually impossible for them to put out the fire to save any structure. And on top of that, all the sidewalks were made out of wood.
Are you serious?
As opposed
wow.
to some of the older cities like Philadelphia or Baltimore or New York at the time, where the sidewalks were brick or concrete. Even the streets, in order to make sure they weren't muddy, were used, cross timbers were used. So the streets were made out
of
wood.
Wow.
So the sidewalks were made out of wood. The streets were made out of wood. This was not what happened in other slower evolving older cities.
Mm-hmm.
So Chicago and a lot of cities in the Midwest were just ready for some horrible thing to happen.
Well, and it's
and
the
it
windy
did.
City. It's the
and
windy
it,
city.
It
so talk about then, Evan, once it started, how long it burned and how it kind of evolved.
Well, it burned for about 2.5 or 3 days. The mm-hmm. fire departments were incapable of putting them out because of the things I just talked about. And the wind spread the fire from the south side across the Chicago River into the north side, where I guess the Golden Mile is and all those now, today, into all those areas. It just moved
so across the river, yeah,
very, very, very rapidly, the wind pushing it, and then it created its own weather.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have looked at AccuWeather.com or any other website or watched the news on what's happening in California, and you've seen some of the pictures or some of the video of firestorms, of almost
fire tornadoes
occurring.
Yeah.
That's what happened in Chicago, the same very thing, but on a bigger scale. What happened in Chicago was a bigger scale than some of the fires you're seeing today. So it caused an actual firestorm. It created its own weather. And it's estimated that winds were sustained as high as 110 miles an hour.
Wow.
So it literally was a firestorm. It incinerated buildings, people, everything in its path, and moved very rapidly, and really just burned itself out. It was they were unable to put it out. Now, General Phil Sheridan from Civil War fame was actually put in charge in the middle of the fire in Chicago of trying to help. Mm-hmm. And he caused some fire breaks to occur. He took a few blocks and destroyed all
just
the buildings.
Destroy them, yeah.
But even that didn't help very much. So in some ways, he was credited with helping to stop the fire. But really, when you look back in history, that really didn't work either. Luckily, only 300 people died because mm-hmm. a lot of people were able to flee, get out of the way, either move west out of the city or actually move into the lake. And there were thousands of people that were just in the lake, a mm-hmm. few feet and whatever with the water, that were able to protect themselves or get out in the water a little bit more than they might otherwise. But there were other cities in the Midwest that weren't as lucky. There was no place to run, no place to hide, and it happened so rapidly that during this same time period, more people died in other fires in the Midwest than died in Chicago, even though Chicago is the most famous because it was a big city.
It was
300,000 people was one of the biggest cities in the U.S. at the time.
So Mother Nature giveth and she taketh away, because it ended up they got some rain that helped.
They did get some rain. There was a frontal system, that a cold front that moved through, that helped with some rain. But it also caused the wind to pick up. And so that didn't really end the fire either. Ended the fire is it ran out of fuel.
Well, let's talk about the actual biggest fire, right, in U.S. history.
Well, the most deadly, yes.
The most deadly occurred at the exact same time, and we haven't heard much about that. Can you talk about that one?
Yeah, the Peshtigo Fire, which is up on the western shore of Green Bay, just north of Green Bay, Wisconsin, in Wisconsin, occurred on October the 8th, the same day the Chicago Fire started. This lasted about a day, and at least 1,500 people died. The entire town was wiped out in a firestorm that was probably more intense than what Chicago had. And Peshtigo is not on the water, so there's a small river that runs through it, but the people were not able to escape. Mm-hmm. And it occurred so fast, the whole town burned down in one day. There was no help, and there was no place to escape. And that is the greatest fire disaster in U.S. history.
And that would have been the same, probably contributing weather
absolutely,
factors
absolutely.
At the time.
In fact, there were fires all over the upper Midwest during the beginning of October. There were several other major fires that occurred in which hundreds of people died the same time the Chicago Fire was going on. So that's another reason why there wasn't a lot of help that was able to be given at the time that this was going on. There was a lot of focus on Chicago, but there were disasters going on everywhere.
Literally putting out fires all over the place.
They were, and they couldn't put them out. They just had to either had to get out of the way, mm-hmm. or if you didn't, you died.
Right. Now, Andy, you were mentioning, because we this day in history, as the podcast drops, you were mentioning another fire that caused a weird smoke, right?
Yeah, the Great Thumb Fire caused something called Yellow Day, where the skies had a yellowish appearance to them.
So it's interesting. The Great Thumb Fire, which occurred in the Thumb of Michigan, 10 years later, 1881, it's kind of like, do we learn from history?
We're hard-headed as human beings.
Those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was repeated. It was called the Great Forest Fire of 1881, or the Great Thumb Fire, or the Huron Fire. And it burned in that part of Michigan mainly on September 5th of 1881. And to similar impact, but not as many people died, but it burned towns down. And the prevailing winds at that time brought that smoke all the way to the east and into the higher part of the atmosphere. And because of that, within a couple of days, places to the east, Boston, for example, mm-hmm. New York, it was called Yellow Day because the sky looked yellow because of the refraction of the sun's rays through the ash and all the debris and the smoke that was put into the middle and higher atmosphere. And so that occurred a few days later. And it really, people said they had to burn candles. No more fires, but they had to burn candles during the middle of the day in places like Boston because it was so dark as it blocked out so much of the sun. So, and that's not unusual to see that kind of sky condition. when Tambora, the volcano, exploded in the what is now Indonesia, and it threw a cubic mile of dust into the high atmosphere. For several years, starting about a year or two later, sunsets looked yellow and reddish and so on because there was so much debris in the high atmosphere from that volcanic eruption, again refracting the sun's rays. But this smoke, this ash didn't go quite as high as that because it didn't have the force. But the yellow sky was probably helped and washed out by rain because it wasn't as high in the atmosphere. You're able to wash
it
out.
Oh, so it hung low.
You're able to wash that stuff out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But from volcanic eruptions, because of the force of spewing it high into the atmosphere and the force of those some of those eruptions, the weather really doesn't have that much impact on it. It has to kind of settle out over years.
Right. And refraction's kind of like a prism. So if you have the sun's light and then depending upon the way it's bent as it hits the different
particles.
Exactly.
And the higher you throw up stuff into the atmosphere, the more impact it has on climate. That's a whole other discussion.
Our next podcast after the Trivial Pursuit one, right, Ken?
Absolutely. Writing it down right now.
After the Tambora volcanic eruption and so much was thrown into the high atmosphere that it actually did have an impact on and it cooled the climate. That's when there were crop failures in New England. That's when Horace Greeley said, "Go west, young man," because New England, you couldn't grow crops. It was pretty terrible. So, yes, that is something we should talk about in the future. And it's interesting because there has been a distinct lack of major volcanic eruption like we had previously in the last 100 or 150 years. And some climate scientists believe that is one of the reasons why the Earth is heating up as fast as it is, because we don't have all that debris in the high atmosphere to block the sun's ultraviolet rays. So, but that's for another time.
Oh, yeah. That's a tease.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, we're going to stop you. I have to stop you because you're going to give us the whole story now. So
there's everything's connected.
Yep.
You know, it's not just that the hip bone's connected to the knee bone. The weather is also.
Yes.
And these things are all connected.
Yes. Well, thanks so much, Evan. Very interesting discussion, and we're going to hold you to both of those podcasts. We want to do the we're going to do the Trivial Pursuit one, and because it's a challenge, the gauntlet has been thrown.
It sounds like I should just stay in the seat.
Yes,
we'll just do a podcast every day.
Yeah, this could be your new office. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
that's true.
Thanks, Evan.
Absolutely.
Always great to have Evan on.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you go against him in weather trivia.
It's not. I am not going up against Evan Myers on weather trivia. I'm going to drag down some of the forecasters upstairs that are going to go up against him.
Do you think anybody's actually going to want to go up against
Evan? No. No wonder he always wins. So, but anyway, we also want to, we're going to be talking to Dan Kudlowski coming up because we want to get an update on the tropics. So that's going to be our next segment here. You'll want to stay tuned for that because the Atlantic has gotten pretty active all of a sudden.
Yeah, with Gordon and some other potential things that
Florence
could affect the area.
Right. So we're going to take a look at that. And we also want to remind you to subscribe to our podcast. We actually have a really good episode that we just did
that
is very appropriate.
Yeah, the Weather and Sports episode, which we did just a few weeks ago, episode 17, I think.
Yes.
We talked with Dean DeVore, the voice of Penn State football, Beaver Stadium, about how you would have to evacuate a stadium. Well, in Lincoln, Nebraska, they had to do that over the weekend because of weather, severe weather that was coming through. Ended up having to cancel the Nebraska game.
Wow.
And evacuate the entire stadium. So.
Right. And Andy said there were some pretty amazing pictures of that.
Yeah, that's a great photo of some lightning striking just within proximity of the stadium. A great shot that they got. So be sure to check out episode 17 of the podcast, Weather in Sports. You can find it on Stitcher, iTunes, or just go to AccuWeather.com/podcast.
Well, the hurricane season all of a sudden seems to be picking up, so I've brought Dan Kudlowski in, our hurricane expert here at AccuWeather. So thanks for taking a few minutes away from the desk here, Dan. All of a sudden, getting very busy.
It's been very busy for me. Actually, since I also cover the Pacific, it's been very busy. Lane hitting, having impacts on Hawaii, and then all of a sudden, we were done with the lane. All of a sudden, we were looking at stuff really going to town across the Atlantic.
So Gordon now is starting to move off into the midsection of the country. What are our concerns with the moisture from Gordon going forth?
Again, it's going to be heavy rain is going to be the big issue. The remnant low that's going to be left over She'd be like over southwest Missouri by Saturday, and then we'll be moving up toward Illinois, Indiana area during the rest of the upcoming weekend. So all it's going to do is help to produce a lot of rainfall. We have a frontal system that's going to be approaching from the west and northwest, and so the interaction of that front and Gordon and its moisture potentially could bring some substantial rainfall across this area. So some of these areas have had some really heavy rainfall over the last several weeks. So putting that on top of that, there's no doubt going to be some major flooding issues from portions of Illinois, Indiana, perhaps into Ohio then.
Now, also, I wanted to ask you about other spots. I had mentioned it was a quieter season in the Atlantic, you know, but it seems like it's picking up now. So what we've got, Florence and...
Florence, and we've got another feature that's near the Cabo Verde Islands that probably will become Helene within the next day or two. So first of all, Florence, again, is out in the middle of the Atlantic. No threat to land all the way through this upcoming weekend. So again, we're telling people if you live in Bermuda that you should probably at least take note of this storm. Keep a little watchful eye on it because it looks like it may be heading toward Bermuda during early next week. The closest approach to Bermuda will be sometime around Tuesday of next week, and that closest approach could be right over. But I'd say that people in interest, visitors and so forth, should certainly be aware of the fact that there could certainly be a hurricane heading their way, you know. And then, of course, beyond that point, some computer information is still suggesting that Florence could try to take a stab at the United States. But I think as you get into next week, we're reaching at what we call the barrier, the forecast barrier of the model output a lot of times.
Okay.
The models tend to waffle on the long range, so I'd be very careful on what we see or hear about in the modeling.
Try not to get too excited too far out, because I noticed that they're both kind of extreme. One's taking it off to the
north,
east and out to...
Yeah, a lot of them have shifted so that the majority of the models are now taking it more westerly, so it's more problematic for the United States. But this is the reason why we tell people living along the coast to have a hurricane plan in place. This is the reason why you have that in place, because all it takes is one storm in a given year, doesn't matter how active it is, and if that storm heads toward your neighborhood or toward your coast, you're going to be devastated, you know. So let's take a look at this, and of course AccuWeather.com will have all kinds of information on this. We'll have stories up and running, and we'll update those stories throughout the rest of this week and through the upcoming weekend so that people understand how they can prepare for the upcoming storm then, if possible.
Right. And the other thing, Dan, I wanted to ask you just real quick is, it was so quiet in the Atlantic the first half of the season. So do you see reason to believe that we're going to see more frequency now for the late part?
Well, I think late August and September are when we have everything coming together. We have very warm water. The shear tends to drop off. Shear is not constant. Shear is like wisps. It's like wind gusts.
Yeah.
So you'll get these strong bursts of wind. They'll die down. And what happens during September is the shear tends to drop off more frequently, and therefore opportunity is there for tropical development much easier. Now, as we get toward the end of the month in October, it goes the other way. The shear starts to increase, especially since we're trending toward an El Nino pattern. That should be the case. That doesn't mean we're going to get rid of the potential altogether, but over the next few weeks here, I'd say at least through the month of September, again, don't let your guard down, because again, there's a lot of activity that could be coming our way, and certainly the computer models are showing at least two more storms that could form in the Far East Atlantic, and one of those could become Helene, is actually projected to move into the Caribbean next week. Now, I'm not saying that's the correct answer, that's the correct
right,
forecast,
but that's kind of what it's
but it's very
disconcerting
to see that kind of a pattern, because we saw that with Irma. I'm not suggesting it's going to be like another Irma, but certainly when you bring a storm westward during September across very warm water, and again, the water temperatures are cool, but as you get to the Caribbean, they're pretty warm. And if it hits a pocket of low shear, boom, we've got ourselves a very, very strong storm.
Good to know. Thanks so much, Dan.
And don't forget, you can stay on top of all of these tropical conditions by downloading the AccuWeather app today.
Next up, we have Elliot Abrams, who has a historical look back at this week in weather.
In the weather forecasting business, it's interesting to look back at the past and wonder whether it indicates what's going to happen in the future. Well, that's a difficult prospect because they aren't really correlated that well. 1953, heat was rampant across the eastern part of the country, just as it has been recently, with afternoon temperatures going to the 90s and past 100. And 1954 was similar, afternoon temperatures breaking records. What did that say about the coming winter? Well, nothing necessarily, but it's interesting to see what some of the things have been. For example, in 1953, there was a large snowstorm in the mid-Atlantic states in early November, even though early September had been hot. In 1954, it had been hot in early September, and then in October, a massive hurricane, Hazel, came ashore in Myrtle Beach. It moved northward through Pennsylvania, ripping down hundreds of thousands of trees. Was the only hurricane that actually caused a hurricane fatality in Canada, moved all the way across eastern part of Lake Erie and western Lake Ontario and destroyed some plains, but it also unfortunately killed some people. So what does that mean about the future? Well, it doesn't really mean that much of anything, but we do know what's on the map today, and that's the remains of Gordon. Some of that moisture will head into the Ohio Valley and then the Northeast as we go through the weekend, along with cooler air coming down from eastern Canada. Then we have Florence roaming the central Atlantic. And some of the computer models are now suggesting it comes all the way to the East Coast at some point late next week. Will it do that, or will it change to some different direction? That's what we'll be talking about on AccuWeather.com during the next several days. But the main thing for this week, the heat will be replaced by cooler air coming into the Northeast during the last few days of the week, and then it'll dry out temporarily from north to south, and then some rain will spread across the Ohio Valley and then into the Mid-Atlantic region at the end of the weekend and early next week. I'm AccuWeather.com meteorologist Elliot Abrams.
Thanks so much, Elliot, and thanks to our guests. Now, next week, we do have Dave Dombeck in the studio.
Yeah, because we are going to be talking about fog.
Right. Well, there's more than one kind. I bet you didn't know that. There's several kinds of fog, and there's also several different scientific causes. So we'll be talking about that. Tune in.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe to the AccuWeather podcast, giving you the stories behind the weather, discussions on trending weather topics, and so much more. New episodes every Thursday. Just search for AccuWeather on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.